This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Daniel Malloy is beginning his 7th year as Connecticut's governor. It's another year with huge challenges. He'll present his budget plan next month that will include proposals to close a $1.5 billion deficit. Now, it's not the first time he's had to find ways to plug huge budget holes since taking office in 2011. It's just one of many challenges he's confronted. And today, he's here in our studio to answer your questions. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. As always, email wherewelive at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. You can also watch our conversation today on Facebook Live right now. Feel free to leave your question in the comment field. We'll get to some of them throughout the show. Also, thanks to the cameras of CTN for covering today's show as well. Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. Nice to be back. And actually, first time I'm here with you.
It's been a crazy few months, so I'm glad to actually have you here finally, right before you've got another busy session before you. I mentioned in the intro it's your beginning your 7th year as governor. Has it moved quickly for you as well?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a busy job. There's lots of things to do, so which I enjoy. I mean, I like to be active and busy and trying to address, in many cases, the long-term difficulties that Connecticut is having. And it fell upon my administration to straighten some of that stuff out.
What do you think of the job you've done so far?
What do I think of the job? I mean, I think we've made a lot of progress. I don't think people realize how much progress has been made. But in 2011, for instance, the first year I was governor, we had negotiations with our employee base and were able to save billions of dollars in long-term obligations. That doesn't mean the job's done. It's not. There's a lot of work to do. It's interesting to be the first governor to appropriately fund the pension obligation because I don't want to do to others what has been done to me. We've reached another mile point marker, perhaps, with respect to flattening in an appropriate way how we fund, getting to a higher amount quicker, but doing it over a longer period of time. Just yesterday, we celebrated that Connecticut is the first state in the nation to end chronic homelessness. Now, what that means is someone is chronically homeless if they've been unhomed for a year in 1 to 3 episodes and has a disability that contributes to that. So many of these folks have physical or mental challenges or dependency challenges. And just this last year, we moved 1,200 people from homelessness to having a home who were in that category. No other state's done that. Just like when we ended homelessness amongst chronic homelessness amongst veterans, the first state in the nation to do that, one of only 3 states now to have ended homelessness for veterans. That doesn't mean people won't become homeless. It means that we have a program to get people permanently housed within 90 days. For that category, those categories of individuals. To be the only state to do something like that is pretty darn amazing, and I'm proud of my state.
It's a great achievement, but you know, traveling around the state, the topic that's on the minds of many residents, many taxpayers in Connecticut is the economy. I'm going to bring up your approval rating from the Q poll. I know in the past when we ask your administration to comment, they'll dismiss it and say there's a lot of hard work, especially after the recession. There have been improvements. But something that I thought was interesting in that poll, the question was asked if these voters thought that you really cared about them, and 61% of them said no. How do you respond to that?
Well, I've had to do really hard things. I mean, when I said that before, I meant it, and I'll say it again. I don't think that the hard work that we've done to reshape Connecticut is fully appreciated. You mentioned the economy. 85,000 jobs have been created in Connecticut since the end of the last recession. But if you ask citizens, they would say that's not true. Well, it is true. So if you take a poll of citizens whether we've created jobs, you'd get a very different answer than the actual reality. To be the first governor who's had to responsibly and has responsibly funded obligations as well as restack those obligations in such a way that they are more affordable, haven't finished that job, but that they're more affordable, more predictable, and more sustainable is hard work, and a lot of feathers get ruffled. It would be great fun to be really popular, and I know how other people have done that. by not doing their job.
You mentioned a lot of the hard work that's been done in your administration, job recovery for one. For people who don't know that number, that 85,000 jobs have been recovered since the start of the recession, in what sectors? Where are we seeing that growth?
Well, it's what's really exciting is we're finally seeing it in manufacturing, advanced manufacturing. I mean, I think if you had – and this was a line in my speech a week or so ago. If you had asked people in Connecticut 10 years ago whether Electric Boat would still be here and, in fact, enlarging their employment, whether Pratt & Whitney would still be here and, in fact, have 7,700 orders for an engine that's going to be produced in Connecticut or that Sikorsky would be bringing a new product line to Connecticut, they would have told you you were crazy. And yet that's what we've done. And I think in light of all of the other things, it's hard for people to put those in perspective. So advanced manufacturing and the supply chain for the defense and advanced manufacturing industry is growing. We've seen a lot of jobs created in a whole bunch of different areas of the economy. You don't create 85,000 jobs without creating some of those in all of all of your or at least most of your categories.
We talk about job growth. There's also been cuts in the past few years, probably more coming this year. Many of those layoffs through attrition, so not actual
so
jobs.
They're not layoffs.
They're not layoffs, right. But are we going to see layoffs this year?
I think that will depend on our ability to or non-ability to reach a different place with the employee unions. I hope we can. I think there's an appreciation that that's probably necessary given all of the circumstances. You know, again, I'll go back to, if you asked people whether Connecticut's state government is 5,000 people smaller than it was in 2008 or whether Dan Malloy's downsized the executive branch of government by 9.2%, your poll would say, no, that didn't happen. But both of those things have happened.
Can we talk about the pension fund? You mentioned it twice. There's a deal that's been reached that will, explain it to our listeners.
We'll get to about a fairly steady contribution of about $2.3 billion, and this is the state employee pension system. There's another pension system that the state plays the most active role in, that's the teachers, and so that's a separate one. To put it in perspective, shortly before I became governor, that contribution was about $800 million a year. So, and has already reached $1.6 billion under my administration. I've had to manage that. 82% of the money we set aside for the state pension program is actually to fund what wasn't funded previously. 82%. I have predecessors and legislatures and bargaining units that entered into agreements with a side agreement that my predecessors didn't have to fund it, that it wouldn't be fully funded for as many as 20 years. Well, when you don't fully fund your pension system, you in essence have a pay-as-you-go system. And although Connecticut recognized back in 1971 they needed to change from a pay-as-you-go system, it's never been properly funded until now.
So if you hadn't reached this deal with the unions, with the retirement system, and I know that the legislature has been voting on that in early February, the payments to the state would actually have been, what, $6 billion?
They would have been lower for a period of time, and then they would have risen to as much as $6 billion, which is an impossibility. That was under an agreement that some of my predecessors entered into with respect to how the pension system would be funded, which was basically we won't fund it.
So what happens long term? So yep. Short term, this is good, right, that you've come up with this deal, not as much money going into the pension fund that could break the bank.
I think you're missing the point. More money will be going into the pension fund for years to come in an effort to flatten out and avoid a crisis that wouldn't be met. So we're getting to a higher payment schedule and maintaining that higher payment schedule. But there's no listener in their right minds to this show today that would expect our pension contribution to go from $800 million to $6 billion and have government do anything else.
Mm-hmm. But we hear from the Republican colleagues that say that more reform needs to happen with the pension system, not just coming up with a deal so that as you're paying more money into the system that it doesn't get pushed further down the road.
I agree. And you're having a conversation with a person who led negotiations that saved $21.5 billion.
In 2011.
In 2011.
What about now?
I just want to put this in perspective. Okay. After years of the legislature and prior administrations not doing their job, we're doing our job, including, I think, educating people to the challenges that were laid for us. There's a line in the speech, State of the State speech, that you know, in the absence, basic absence of other people having done their job, it's fallen on this generation to pay those bills. That's unfair. I mean, that would someone should be unpopular because of that. But probably shouldn't be the person who's trying to straighten it out. And I agree, we have to make more changes. But we didn't get into this hole overnight. You're not going to get out of it overnight. But I absolutely agree, and you know, the budget will reflect that.
You're again presenting your budget to the legislature next month. Will you be asking the state employee unions for more concessions?
Did you read my speech, or did you?
I read parts of it. Yeah.
So there we use the C word. Mm.
But we're on the show now. I know many listeners want to know, you know, how are you going to help the economy even more?
Well, I think helping the economy is about investing. I mean, I think transportation is a gigantic problem in the state of Connecticut. We are not sharing our fair share of New York City area growth, in part because people don't think that you can get into and out of Fairfield County anywhere other than Greenwich and Stamford from the New York area. That growth should be spread out certainly as far as Bridgeport, but we don't have a transportation system that allows that to happen. We're losing opportunities and losing jobs. If you look at what's happened in the tri-state area, 9 out of 10 jobs growth have actually occurred in New York City. In Brooklyn and Manhattan in particular.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today I'm speaking with Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy. We're getting a lot of questions from our listeners related to state pension obligations. A listener is asking, is it possible to negotiate concessions from current retirees and what they are currently receiving? Is that possible?
Not realistically. Not in some cases, there could be adjustments to things like what's the copay on medications and things like that. But if you're talking about actual pension obligations, and I think that's what the question is directed to, short of a bankruptcy, I don't think so.
I'll take a call now. John's calling from Manchester. John, you're on the show.
Hi, good morning, Governor. I wanted to ask you a quick question. I was privy to a bill that was proposed that would put a 30% tax on pensions where the pensioner has moved out of the state. Say if they retire to Florida, they have 30% surcharge on their pension. I wanted to know, one, your opinion on that, and two, if you think that's actually legal. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Sure. No, I mean, it's not legal. You can't do that. There are things such as commerce clauses and the rights of people to live in the states that they want to live. And working for a state is not permanent servitude to that state. So it's just not legal.
You can ask the governor a question, 860-275-7266. Bill's calling from Windsor Locks. Bill, you're on the show.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to ask the governor, does he think it's fair for to the taxpayers of Connecticut to allow a system that allows state employees to work outrageous overtime hours for only 3 years, thus padding their salary for their retirement? What is he going to do about pension padding?
I don't believe it's fair. I don't believe it's appropriate. Let me go a little step further. I was mayor of a city for 14 years. Pensions were based on base pay, not overtime. There were no automatic COLAs, and the pension plans were fully funded. I know what it takes to run one of these systems. I just wish that my predecessors hadn't given away the store. And getting benefits that have previously been negotiated out of contracts, quite frankly, the system is set up in such a way to make that almost impossible to do. But we made some major progress in 11, and we need to make some major progress now.
We're getting a tweet from a listener, Stephen, saying that while we were talking about some of the achievements in your administration since 2011, he wants you to take responsibility for what you did wrong during those years.
Okay.
Is there anything that you think you've done wrong?
I think what we've done wrong is simply put, not enough. You know, we've got to keep moving. We've got to keep making investments. You know, I think one of my disappointments was that the legislature failed to put the lockbox issue on the ballot. A lockbox would be to say that monies that are raised for transportation can only be spent on transportation. Now, having said that, that's what I'm doing, but I believe that that should be part of our state constitution so that what other people have done and which I changed over the first few years that I became governor was that money for transportation would only be spent. One of the reasons that we are underinvested in transportation is just that monies were diverted from that cause. You know, we compete with New York and we compete with Boston. Both of those jurisdictions have spent massive amounts on transportation at a time that we've spent almost nothing. And so it takes a while. I guess I'm disappointed how long it takes to change the trajectory of a state with respect to issues like transportation. But it's important to get done. I think on the education side, I think we need to make a lot more progress pre-K through 12. I wish we had universal pre-kindergarten. We have something approaching that, but we don't have it yet. That's a disappointment. I wish the economy was more robust so that we could pay for that so that no child would be denied a quality pre-kindergarten learning experience. But I believe as we sort out our long-term and short-term obligations, we're going to get there.
I'll take one more call before the break. Jackie's calling from West Hartford. Jackie, you're on the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question or comment?
Great. First, Governor, I'd like to thank you for your service. I know it's a hard job, and I really appreciate everything you and your colleagues are doing.
Thank you.
Having said that,
there was a second part.
Well, of course there's a second part. Doesn't mean I don't appreciate everything you're doing.
I got it. I got it.
I have a question about the tax burden. I've been living in the state for about 20 years. I moved up from Virginia, and I still have a lot of friends in Virginia. And quite honestly, the tax difference is huge, and I'm talking state and local, not federal. I think I was just looking online. Our state and local tax burden for the median income is about 10 grand. I think we're the highest in all the states. And I personally think that has a direct correlation to people leaving the state, you know, both retirees and people like myself, you know, between state and local taxes. In West Hartford, there's the property tax, our mill rate. I know you've talked about mill rates. It's really hard to live here, and I love living here. I travel around the country. This is the nicest state. We have incredible universities, UConn, Central, in my own town of West Hartford, you know, St. Joseph's. We have incredible schools, incredible elementary schools. We educate amazing, amazing people of all ages, and they can't stay here. It's hard for me to stay here, and I love living here. It's a beautiful state. We're well-educated. We can do so much for employers. You know, I personally think our state motto, instead of still revolutionary, should say, guess what? We're not North Carolina. I mean, we are an amazing place to live and work. So, I just feel the tax burden is choking us. Can you help?
Sure. I'm trying. So to put it in perspective and again talking about what people actually recognize, I think most people think that I'm spending far more money per year than any of my predecessors, and the opposite is true. Increased expenditures on the statewide basis have been at the smallest numbers, and in fact we're minus numbers last year or in the current fiscal year. I think the problem with Connecticut is, A, it hasn't grown, and I would say that part of that lack of real vital growth, and Fairfield County has experienced growth in balancing off some of the other areas, but the lack of growth means that folks got in the habit of going back to the well and going back to the well. But they didn't just go back to the well to get more money. They then made promises to people for political purposes that were not in the best interest of the state government, made them popular to give more money and more promises and more benefits to folks with a side agreement not to fund those. I I sign on to everything you just said, and every day I work at that. Every single day, we're looking for ways to spend our money far more efficiently. For instance, in our criminal justice system, and specifically in corrections, we cut $70 million out of the budget. Lowest prison population in a very, very long time, I think going back to the early 90s. Lowest crime rate in 50 years. Recidivism is down. We're doing something right. In the last 3 years, not including the one that just ended because we don't have the actual statistics yet, Connecticut had the largest drop in violent crime of any state in the nation, and we did it by more than 30% over the next lowest or the next largest drop in violent crime. That allows us to save money. This whole issue that I referenced previously about ending chronic homelessness, the problem with those who are chronically homeless is they then eat up all kinds of additional services. They're at the hospital emergency room on a regular basis. They don't maintain health care. They don't maintain a job. They're not able to contribute. Every time I will go so far as to say that if you look at the 1,200 people that we moved from chronic homelessness in the past 12 months, we're saving a tremendous amount of money, maybe not on every one of those, but on a aggregate basis by having done that. Somebody should have done that years ago. And I'm not just talking about 7 years ago. Maybe we should have gotten it done earlier. But no other state has done it. All of these things, the bad decisions over multiple generations don't get changed in a single generation. But you can make yearly progress, and I think that's how we have to measure that. Now, that may not be enough to keep you in the state. And by the way, I always like to point out that a lot of people retire to warmer weather because they like warmer weather. They don't all necessarily leave because of high taxes. And if you look at the number of people who move to warmer weather but keep a residence here, it's pretty high as well. Having said that, I actually agree with you. I really do.
So what are some ways to change that perception? You mentioned that you are cutting spending. There are savings happening. But when we talk about places where people want to go, you mentioned warm weather. Or if someone's young and they're out of college, they want to go to Boston or New York.
Or Stanford or New Haven. Mm-hmm. And hopefully in the future, Bridgeport and Hartford. We've brought 1,100 units online in downtown housing in Hartford. And they're renting up. Just put that in perspective. 1,100 units in a relatively short period of time, and they're renting up very rapidly. That will make Hartford more vital. Doing something about the high property taxes in those urban environments that you've talked about or that I just referenced is a very important part of the long-term strategy. You know, in America, we pursued a large policy for most of the last 50 years that if you wanted to live in a city, you were going to pay higher taxes, have higher crime, and not have as good as schools. We need to change that dynamic in our own state. There shouldn't be a penalty to live where you want to live. There probably should be a plus.
We're going to hear more about some of your plans for 2017. Take more of your calls. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. We're going to come back just in a moment, but here's our phone number, 860-275-7266. You can also watch this conversation live on Facebook. Look for At Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. In studio with me today, Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy. He's here to answer questions about the challenges ahead and take your questions and join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email us at wherewelive@wmpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Governor Malloy, we wanted to ask you about new revenue streams. And one of our listeners is also asking about this on Facebook, and that is what chance is there to get tolls similar to what Massachusetts has? No toll booths needed, rather. We would only need them on the borders. We'd raise enough to pay back the price of that toll technology. What are your thoughts?
Border tolls will not be approved by the federal government. Just as the system that you reference in Massachusetts is not border tolls. It's the tolling of a road system in its entirety. And the federal policy against border tolls is pretty significant and has been exercised relatively recently in the case of Rhode Island. So if we're going to have a toll discussion, we should have a mature one about what is legal and what is not legal, and simply having tolls at your border is not legal. I would prefer that the legislature had approved for the citizenry to approve, and I'm sure they would have, a lockbox that would make sure that any monies raised, including from any other source that might be added, would only be spent on transportation. I've often said that that really needs to be the precursor to a broader discussion. Having said that, since they didn't do that, we are running out of transportation dollars because people are going further and further on the same gallon of gas, and lots of cars are not even using gas or oil for that matter. So we better do something soon to resolve that issue. Otherwise, the plans, including the designs and the engineering that we're doing currently, will not come to fruition because there'll be insufficient amounts of money to spend. Back to the tolls, even if we were to decide today we wanted tolls, and I don't think there's a political consensus yet that that's the case, it would take probably 4 years to institute from the time that an from the time the legislature acted. So it's not a panacea to our immediate problems, I think we missed when Republicans in the legislature blocked a supermajority vote to get it on the ballot last November, we lost time. And I think that's costly to the state.
Another tweet from Roger. A lot of transportation talk, but how can the governor address why infrastructure is so expensive to build? He writes, Metro North is just sad.
Is just what?
Metro North is just sad, he says.
Actually, at Metro North, we've made some really dynamic improvements on Metro North in Connecticut. It's not where it should be. I'm not happy where it is, but it's a lot better than it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. The catenary system replacement will be completed years in advance of when that was scheduled. That was not scheduled to be done, I think, until 2022. We'll have it done sometime next year. So we're cutting 4 years off of that schedule. Signalization modernization is underway as we speak, not just on the main line, but on the other lines as well. We've increased the new car order very substantially. The fleet serving the New York route has entirely been replaced. So we are making improvements, and a lot of our early transportation spending is, in fact, directed at mass transit. I'd also like to see the bus system expanded very substantially. And we have a real success to point to with Connecticut Fast Track, which is this short line, about 8.3 miles, if I remember correctly. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong about that. But between Hartford and New Britain, so much so that people east of the river want an expansion of that kind of service east of the Connecticut River.
And what's going on with the rail between New Haven and Springfield?
That will open sometime next year, as early as January, as late as perhaps spring. In part, it might be delayed because we have appropriated more money to double track more of that system, and it might make sense to hold off, even though the bulk of the system will be completed, until we get the final segment that we're double tracking. You know, that was once a four-track system, which was discontinued and then torn up piece by piece by piece. So that system will, in fact, be a brand new system of tracks from New Haven to Hartford to Springfield and hopefully well beyond.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Governor Dana Malloy is here to take your calls and questions, 860-275-7266. Michael's calling from Meriden. Michael, what's your question?
Hi, Dana Malloy. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
I wanted to ask you what Connecticut's plans for medical and recreational cannabis use is as far as it pertains to the budget.
What?
And just as a comment, I'm a recent new home buyer, and because of the mill rate for where I live in Meriden, I mean, my taxes, property taxes, are almost half of my mortgage, which amazes me. And I know somebody commented on that earlier, but my main question was just about recreational and medical cannabis in the state and what your plans are for that.
Let me just ask you a question. Do you know what your property taxes are in Meriden?
The mill rate?
No, mill rate or how much your total taxes are.
Total tax for my house is about $400 a month or something.
Right. I mean, that's a big tax bill. I think we should find a way to effectively cap mill rates. I think the disparity that exists from communities that have very low mill rates to communities that are really making a comeback like Meriden, and we're doing some amazing work down there, doesn't allow us to make the kind of progress that we'd like to see. So I do think that property taxes are a big issue. That doesn't mean it's a universal issue, because there are places where the mill rates are relatively low. The cannabis you've asked, I've said this before. I'm not an endorser of cannabis use. I led the drive to decriminalize it in 2011. I led the drive and pushed it over to completion to have medical marijuana. I'm personally not in favor of endorsing its use, and I think how much money you get out of something is not the right judgment to make about whether we should be in the business of endorsing it.
Obviously, there's lots of stress on cutting spending, but when we talk about new revenue streams, what are the options out there?
You want to talk about more taxes. I don't. I mean,
It's a question people have.
Sure. No, I'm not picking on you.
I can take it.
Yeah, no. Listen, we have a gigantic issue to deal with. It's, 1.5, $1.7 billion adjustments we need to make to the budget to not raise taxes at all. That would be my preference, whether that's possible based on agreements that we have to reach with folks to get to a point where we can manage that kind of change. There are all kinds of you can raise money any way you want. It's government. What I would prefer to do is that we raise that we take care of our problems to a far greater extent by resolving those problems than simply going back to the well. Having said that, unfortunately, I've had to be governor during a period of time when the bills finally came due with respect to long-term obligations. And at the same time, certain revenue sources started to shrink very substantially, not the least of which is gaming in Connecticut at our some of the largest in the world casinos. That revenue has dropped precipitously. I've had to deal with shrinking revenue, and people forget that as well.
There is a push to have a third casino. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, here's another ambivalence for me. I'm not a big casino person. I mean, I grew up in an America where there was exactly one place where you could go legally gamble, and that was Nevada. And in some senses, I think that might have been a better United States. Having said it, you can't argue that gaming has become ubiquitous, and how we manage those assets in light of challenges coming at us from states that had not been in the gaming business and decided to get into the gaming business, I think is a legitimate question. But it's not one where I intend to lead the discussion, but it's one that I will participate in the appropriate management of.
We'll take more calls now. Greg's holding from Fairfield. Greg, you're on the show.
Thank you very much, Governor. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. So I'm a New York lifetime resident that moved to the state of Connecticut. Actually, I've been doing quite a bit of traveling around the world. And so I just want to ask a question.
Sure.
And then I'm going to give you an opportunity to answer it. And I want to thank you for your courage in taking on the fiscal problems of the state at this time.
Thank you.
But this is a bipartisan question, and here it goes.
All right.
So why are millennials and future generations expected to accept less than an affordable education, a living wage, and a secure retirement? Because it seems that the fiscal crisis that faces us right now, this is exactly what my generation is looking at. So I just want to give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Well, I don't think that should be the equation, quite frankly. And I've done lots of things to try to make sure that is not the final equation that plays out in the state of Connecticut. That doesn't mean that you can do things that you can't afford to do as a state. But it does mean that we can make appropriate adjustments. We had the best implementation of ACA, Obamacare, in the country. Other people get that title. We actually had the best implementation. we have dropped to such an extent our uninsured number of uninsured individuals. That makes a difference in people's lives. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people's lives in our own state. Increasing the minimum wage from where it was to now $10.10 has brought relief. Paid sick leave for hourly workers has brought relief and made lives better. But I agree with you. The idea that the federal government makes money, and I'm not, maybe they should make a little money on student loans, but that they make massive amounts of money on student loans is patently unfair. And is anti-investment that the family or individuals making in their own education. So that should change. I think that there are lots of things that we need to get done. And I honestly try to take those things on a daily basis. I look for the kind of inequities that you're referencing and the unfairness of it all at the same time that I struggled to deal with a state that made really bad decisions for a really long period of time and yet is one of the most beautiful and productive and interesting and safe and healthy places to live in the world.
There's a lot of good pluses, but the perception, again, when you're out of Connecticut, you hear people complain here about Connecticut and the cost of living, the business climate. When you're out of Connecticut, people aren't hearing what you just said, the positives. How can Connecticut do a better job marketing itself?
Well, I think on a national basis, as somebody who gets around the nation, Connecticut actually has a much more favorable view from the outside than it does the inside. And I sometimes joke that, you know, Connecticut's the place where the glass that can only be half empty was invented. I could just riff off statistics. We're the best readers we're the best readers in 12th grade in the nation. We're tied as the best readers in 8th grade in the nation. After 5 years of decline in high school graduation rates, we've had 5 years of increase in graduation rates and now graduate a higher percentage of our students than ever before. And quite frankly, it means more because we have more children living in poverty taking advanced placement courses and passing those courses as one measurement. I mean, I could riff on really great stuff about Connecticut, including the fact that we're actually for the first time in our history effectively, albeit on a long-term basis, dealing with our deficiencies in transportation, in funding of our long-term obligations, in fairness to our population, in improving our health. We're one of the top three healthiest states in the nation, even though our senior population is the seventh largest. Imagine that. We managed to be one of the healthiest places in the country, even though the audience of people who get sick and cost a lot of money is larger in our state than it is in other states. That's remarkable. But nobody wants to celebrate everything. They want everything to be perfect overnight, and that's just not realistic. Listen, I could tell you I could do it. I know the words. I'm going to solve everything today. But it wouldn't be true. On the other hand, I'm going to go back to the office and work really hard to resolve the things that I can resolve today and lay plans to resolve the things that I can't resolve today to resolve them in the future.
We do want to ask you your plans to help make education more equitable across the state. We need to take another break, and we'll get to more calls. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. That number, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today I'm speaking with Connecticut Governor Dana Malloy, who's live in studio. You can see the conversation on Facebook Live if you search at Where We Live. We've got a number of callers who want to ask you a few questions, Governor. But, you know, I wanted to ask you about state aid and how that's going to change in this new session.
Well, again, I will go back to it's a broader discussion about how much money we spend. About $5.2 billion of the state budget, which is about $19 billion to $20 billion. So about 22% of that actually goes to local governments and directly or indirectly supports local governments. So it's a big, gigantic part of our budget. And in reflecting on the budget and the inequality of things like mill rates and who has the largest amount of non-taxable property, we probably need to spend that money more wisely, and we probably need to spend it in such ways that it makes it more likely that communities will make a comeback than less likely.
So you've made remarks, I think it was lately, to the group that represents small towns,
right.
COST, about how state aid will need to be allocated more fairly to municipalities that really need it, that have that burden because they don't have a lot of tax revenue to pull from, such as Hartford. Mayor Luke Bronin, who used to be in your administration, has been traveling around to the suburbs saying that, you know, for Hartford to succeed and to not to go bankrupt, we need to help the city. So what can these small towns expect if they're not going to see that same state aid? What's their future in terms of when we talk about the fact that people are worried about high taxes?
Well, I think let's talk about that. I mean, I think that a formula needs to take into account what the local tax obligation is, as well as the other obligations such as education or concentrations of poverty. But what we've designed is a system that largely ignores that, and that's not a good system. So I think what everyone should expect is fairness.
There was a formula, education cost sharing, is that right?
ECS.
I've heard from advocates it's never really fully been funded. So how will you, if you're going to give more money to municipalities that need it to help with such things as education costs, how do you hold them accountable?
Well, you know, people say lots of things and ignore lots of things. So you know, if something in column A isn't just right, you criticize that and you ignore the fact that column B you might be getting more money than you had anticipated. For instance, we disperse money in lots of different ways to local governments at $5.2 billion, which, by the way, has gone up since I've been governor, not down. But I think there is a reality that we need a system that's fair. And people can disagree with me. That's legitimate, and the legislature will have a role to play. But how do you expect Hartford to make the kind of comeback that we want it to make when its mill rate is as high as 76 mills, and if you adjust it because it's the one jurisdiction where housing under 4 units are assessed differently than they are anywhere else in the state, it still comes into something that's in the high 50s compared to a community that's on its borders where the mill rate's in the 20s. I mean, it just how do you expect that to happen? How do you expect people to make large-scale investments and keep their employees in a jurisdiction which has that kind of mill rate? So we got to address it. Back to Luke Bronin, he doesn't listen. I told him not to run. He went out and did it, and he's doing a great job.
Let's take some calls. Kimberly is calling from East Haven. Kimberly, you're on the show.
Good morning, Governor Malloy.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for taking the time this morning to explain to us some of our budget challenges. So a lot, we had heard from this woman from West Hartford talking about her tax burden, but then she went on to explain what those taxes pay for, how we have great schools here. I have a lot of Connecticut pride. I really believe that, we care very much about our impoverished people here. We believe in providing Medicaid and state services. And so I don't prescribe to the notion that our taxes are too high, though I do think that our richest 1%ers aren't paying their fair share. So what can we do as a state to ensure that we're closing corporate tax loopholes and that we're raising income taxes on our highest earners so that our 1%ers here in the state are sharing the burden?
So our 1%ers in our state pay 35% of all income tax in the state. I just want that to sink in. 1% pays 35% of all. And this concept that we can simply keep raising money disproportionately on a population of people compared to other states and expect those people to remain in our state I think a fallacy. It doesn't mean that we don't ask everyone to do more. I think we have done that, and including having raised taxes on that 1%. But the idea that you can have a goose that lays golden eggs and eat it and still have eggs produced doesn't make any sense. So I think finding the right balance is what we need to strive for. And by the way, that 1% wasn't responsible for the state not funding its obligations, which is the reason we're in the mess we're in, any more than the bottom 1% was responsible for it. So we're in this together, folks. This is hard work. Making a state that our children will be happy in, healthy in, well-educated in is hard work given how far behind we allowed ourselves to become. But having said all of that, we're making progress every single day.
We're only got about a few more minutes left, Governor, but I did want to ask you about Second Chance. It's something that you've gotten a lot of attention for. A few proposals that didn't make it through the legislature last year, I think it was bail reform and then also raising the age of juvenile jurisdiction. Do you anticipate bringing those up again this session and why?
He's back. Yeah, of course I do. I don't think people should be in jail because they're poor. I think they should be in jail because they present risks. To themselves or to others, but not because they're poor. Somebody who can't make bail of $100 because they don't have it in their pocket the day they were arrested, we shouldn't be putting up at a cost of $168 a day. It doesn't make sense.
Is there anything in the proposal that you're changing so that the legislature will approve it?
I think if they had called a vote, it would have been approved last year. I always listen to people. I hear their suggestions, and they'll be reflected in legislation. But the legislation will have the same purpose, and that is to save the taxpayers of the state of Connecticut a lot of money, and secondly, to be consistent with our own Constitution. Our Constitution basically says you can't be incarcerated because you're poor, and yet we're doing it.
And what about raising the age of juvenile jurisdiction?
Doesn't that make sense? I mean, I'll give you an example.
I think the legislature worried about some people that had violent backgrounds that might have been eligible for this. So how do you fix that concern?
Well, I mean, violent background. If somebody goes out and murders somebody, that's different than somebody had a fight in a school. But both are violent. Do we really want to take an 18-year-old kid who gets in a fight with a 17-year-old kid and have the 18-year-old end up with a criminal record and not have the 17-year-old end up with a criminal record? Do we really want to penalize ourselves and that individual to the same extent because a police officer was in the school and arrested them both for fighting? I mean, I had fights when I was in high school. But I lived in a different world where we didn't simply jump to the prospect of permanently punishing someone. And I think that's part of what happened in America. Because we saw crime rising rapidly, we overreacted. I'm just trying to set the level back to where it needs. Violent offenders, folks listening today, are doing more time in Connecticut than ever before under any other governor. And yet our prison population is falling because we're doing a better job of keeping young people out of jail to the tune of well in excess of 50% fewer young people going to jail. You know what you get when you go to jail, when you go to prison? You get an advanced degree in criminal behavior. We should stop giving them out to the greatest extent that we can while we continue to drop crime and particularly violent crime in our state.
Just another minute left, Governor Malloy. Next Friday, we're going to have a new president in the White House. What are your thoughts on President-elect Donald Trump?
I disagree with him profoundly on many big policy issues. ACA perhaps is the one that will affect more people more immediately than anything else. That's Obamacare. On the other hand, I will mark that occasion, as I think we should as Americans, that this is a day where in our democracy we peacefully hand over from one party to another the presidency. And I think that's an important celebration that we should have. And then we should go back to fighting about important policy issues. And I'm going to use my voice to do that.
Real quick, you mentioned ACA. If it's repealed and replaced, as the administration is saying, what would happen to – how many people are going to be affected by this in Connecticut?
Hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. And not to the positive.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank Connecticut Governor Dana Malloy for coming in and taking our calls and our comments from our listeners. The hour goes by too quickly. We'd like to have you back.
I'll come back.
Before the session ends?
I like your voice. I'll come back.
That's it?
That's it. No, I like you as well.
I know. I understand you're a porcupine, Governor Malloy.
There you go.
I appreciate your time. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Our producers are Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson, executive producer Katie Talarski, technical producer Kion Wolf. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Thanks for listening.